Welcome to the new HIPAA rules and what to do now to avoid increased penalties conference call. My name is Robert, and I will be your operator for today's call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question and answer session. Please note that this conference is being recorded. I will now turn the call over to Ms. Julie Simer. Ms. Simer, you may begin.
Thank you. We're going to be talking about HIPAA. HIPAA is a statute that was enacted in 1996 in order to protect health information and the security and privacy of that health information. Many people are probably familiar with HIPAA. It's usually a document you're handed in when you walk into a physician's office and you're asked to sign an acknowledgement. But what HIPAA does is it protects what is referred to in the statute as protected health information. Protected health information is the health information that is connected to an individual so they can be identified. So when my health records get attached, have my name on them, or have another identifier that can link those health records to me, it becomes protected health information. Now, what isn't protected health information is de-identified health information. So, in other words, there's no connection to an individual person. Health information in education records or employment records, those are not protected health information. And if once a person has been deceased for 50 years, under the new rules, that's no longer protected health information. But HIPAA is really a statute that gave the authority to the U.S. Health and Human Services Department to implement standards for the protection and security of what we'll refer to from now on protected health information as PHI. So HHS implemented those standards in the form of three rules. The rules are known as the privacy rule, the security rule, and the enforcement rule. The privacy rule is to ensure the privacy of the protected information, and it sets forth the ways in which that information can be used and the rights of individuals to their own health records. The security rule only applies to electronic form of PHI, and it requires certain parties to implement safeguards to protect that electronic PHI. Finally, the enforcement rule provides the rules governing the compliance requirements, the process of investigations, the grounds for establishing civil monetary penalties, and the procedures for hearings and challenging a determination. One more thing before we jump into the rules is that HIPAA has some definitions for certain parties. One definition is covered entity. A covered entity is one of three things: either a healthcare provider that transmits PHI electronically, in these days, who doesn't, because claims are typically submitted to health plans electronically. And that's the second category. Health plans are covered entities. The third category is healthcare clearing houses, which basically are the place that acts as a conduit for the transfer of the electronic PHI. So those three things, the providers, the health plans, and the healthcare clearinghouses, are covered entities. Now, when these individuals or businesses that engage other businesses or individuals to perform services that require them to create or receive or maintain or transmit PHI, these other individuals that are doing services for the covered entity are called business associates. Now, we'll be talking more about the requirements for business associates and the contracts that they enter into with the covered entities. On January 25th, a new HIPAA omnibus rule was issued. And this rule is essentially four different types of rules rolled into one massive 523-page rule. So with that, let's turn to slide number three. Brooke, what's new with the final rule?
Well, generally, what's new in this final omnibus rule is it implements many provisions of the 2009 High-Tech Act. It also modifies the HIPAA privacy rule to strengthen protection for PHI. It heightens breach reporting obligations on covered entities, as well as business associates now. And there's sweeping new responsibilities for business associates, which we'll get into significant detail later. Other notable things about the omnibus rule, which are not the subject of this teleseminar but are worth noting, are there are new limitations on selling PHI. There are changes to the rules regarding fundraising and also using genetic information for underwriting purposes. But again, those are discussions for a different day. So, Julie, for our listeners on the phone, what do they have to do to comply with this final omnibus rule?
Well, Brooke, you know I love definitions. So let me give you one more before I tell you that. Another definition is the Notice of Privacy Practices. The Notice of Privacy Practices is a written notification that's given to an individual because an individual has a right to receive adequate notices of the uses and disclosures of their PHI. It also is a description of the individual's rights and legal duties with respect to that PHI. So, the NPP, or Notice of Privacy Practices, is that thing that you usually receive when you go into the doctor's office. So, when you ask what do we have to do, well, those Notice of Privacy Practices must, in many cases, be revised, be posted, or maybe redistributed, and we'll talk about that. The agreements between the covered entities we talked about and the business associates are called business associate agreements, and they will need to be revised. Business associates must also take steps to comply with the new HIPAA rules that didn't apply to them before or are more extensive than in the last go-round. Business associates will also, and I'm on slide five, business associates will also need to enter into business associate agreements with their own business associates, which are really their subcontractors. Again, we'll talk about that a little more. And finally, our covered entities and business associates will need to revise policies and procedures regarding the breach reporting. So how quickly do we have to do this?
So of the three big things that you have to do about revising and posting the Notice of Privacy Practices, the deadline for that is for providers on or promptly after March 26, 2013. Unfortunately, there's no real guidance on what promptly thereafter means, so a good date to shoot for to get your Notice of Privacy Practices ready to go is March 26, 2013. Now, that's for providers. For health plans, it really depends on if the plan has a website. If the health plan has a website, then they must post the revised Notice of Privacy Practices by March 26, 2013, and then send out the revised notice or a summary of what the revised notice is by at the next annual mailing to the members. If the health plan does not have a website, they have to send them out to all of their members within 60 days of March 26, 2013, so that would be May 25, 2013. Now, for business associate agreements, we have until September 23, 2013 to revise and enter into new agreements with our business associates. There is a limited grandfathering period for certain agreements that are currently in compliance with the HIPAA rule and are not set to be renewed or renegotiated until September 23rd, 2014. Now, again, there's limitations to that. They cannot be revised at all in the meantime. They have to be in effect and compliant as of the current date. But if they meet the grandfathering period, then there's an extended timeline of September 23rd, 2014. But if a new business associate agreement needs to be created, the deadline is September 23rd, 2013. And the date to revise policies and procedures to comply with the new breach standard is September 23rd, 2013. So, Julie, we generally know what the changes have to be and when they have to be made by, but who specifically has to make these changes?
Well, the parties that have to make the changes are the ones we talked about before. Covered entities, in this case, providers who have a direct treatment relationship with an individual, health plans, and health care clearinghouses. In some circumstances, a business associate, although generally a business associate doesn't have to provide a notice of privacy practices, if the covered entity's original business associate agreement with them required them to provide the notice, then they would be required. And consequently, other parties downstream from them would also have that contractual requirement. So again, it would be important to check the specific business associate agreement in order to know the answer to that question.
So, Julie, going back to Notice of Privacy Practices, this is slide 8, what does the revised Notice of Privacy Practices need to say?
Well, there are certain things that need to be in it. And first of all, is the individual's right to be notified in the event of a breach. I think we all would want to be notified if our protected health information were exposed in some way. Secondly, the individual's right to request that a health plan not be informed of their treatment if they've paid in full for that particular treatment. And so the NPP must explain the covered entity's obligation to comply with that new requirement. Next, consent is required prior to the use or disclosure of psychotherapy notes. So your NPP must explain that an authorization must be obtained before there can be further disclosure of a patient's psychotherapy notes. Now, I know that many providers do not include their psychotherapy notes within the medical record to avoid problems in this regard. But it's something to be very careful of, and it must be included in the Notice of Privacy Practice. On slide 9, the NPP must also explain the individual's right to opt out of communications that are made for fundraising purposes, and it must include a statement that a health plan is prohibited from disclosing genetic information for underwriting purposes, but that applies only to health plans, and that's in regard to the new rules which have to do with GINA, G-I-N-A, the statute that prohibits health plans from using genetic information like family medical history for underwriting purposes. So, Brooke, what do we do with this revised notice?
Okay, so you have your new Notice of Privacy Practices. It's been revised to include all of those things that the final omnibus rule says it has to have in it. So now the question is, what do you do with it? So for providers, the rule is you must post the revised Notice of Privacy Practices in a prominent and accessible location. So you got a good example of that would be to post it in the waiting room of the physician's office. If you just put in the frame, let's say, a summary of what the changes are, make sure that the patient has access to the full new notice of privacy practices so in somewhere close proximity to the summary thereof, meaning maybe put a stack of them next to the framed notice that you posted on the wall. But the thing you have to be careful of is you can't make the person ask for it. the full notice has to be there, readily accessible for the person, so they don't have to, you know, go digging around for it. Also, for new patients, providers will need to give a full copy of the new notice of privacy practices to all new patients with a signed acknowledgement form. So it's important for providers to receive a signed acknowledgement form that new patients have received the notice of privacy practices. Now, for health plans, as we mentioned before, if you've got a website, go ahead and post the new notice of privacy practices on the website. And if you don't have a website, then you'll need to send a copy to all enrollees now rather than at the next annual mailing. So, Julie, what were those dates again that we need to keep in mind of specifically as they relate to notice of privacy practices?
Well, Brooke, it sounds to me like it's March 26th, 2013, and then if you're a provider, and if your health plan, March 26th, 2013, if you have a website, and if not, May 25th, 2013. I think those are the important dates. So, Brooke, what's our first step on slide 12?
So, specifically as it relates to business associate agreements and getting those in compliance with the final omnibus rule, the first thing that you want to look at is you want to review all existing business arrangements to determine if certain contractors are now considered business associates under the final rule. This is important because the final rule has expanded greatly the definition of what a business associate is. It includes anyone who, quote, creates, receives, maintains, or transmits PHI on behalf of a covered entity, even if they never view the information that they store. So this could mean that contractors who were never business associates in the past are now considered business associates under the new rule, and covered entities will need to have a business associate agreement with them. This can include companies like storage companies, who they don't see the information that they have, but they have it, they're maintaining it for the covered entity, so you better be sure you have a business associate agreement with them. So it's important to conduct an inventory of all existing business associates, business associate agreements, as well as any contractors that you deal with to make sure that they don't fit under the new definition of the rule or to see if the existing business associate agreement needs to be revised, which it almost certainly does. So turning on to slide 13, the second step is to ask what your business associates do to protect the PHI and make sure that they ask their subcontractors the same question. Now, it's important that business associates ask their subcontractors the same questions because under the new definition, subcontractors are also considered business associates. So it's not just the business associates who contract with the covered entities themselves. It's also the business associates of the business associates. Now, does that mean that a covered entity needs to ask to see what protections as the subcontractors of a subcontractor has in place regarding PHI? And really the regulator's guidance on that is that a covered entity's job is to get reasonable assurances that their business associates and the business associates of their business associates are protecting the protected health information. So really that's a decision point for the covered entity as well as business associates. How much evidence are you going to require from your business associates about what their protection mechanisms are? Of course, your business associate agreement is going to address that, but really it's a comfort level and it's a decision point for contractors to look into. Moving on to slide 14, the third step on getting prepared for the new changes to business associate agreements is to revise your form business associate agreement to comply with the requirements of the final rule. So how exactly do we do this? Turn on slide 15. Julie, what does our new business associate agreement need to say?
Well, first thing, a lot of people are going to be looking for a form to do this. So the HHS put a form on its website, and those are some of the requirements that need to be within the BAA. However, there are decision points in that sample that's on the web, and if you go through it, there's some really important questions that need to be worked out before you can have the business associate agreement completed. For example, who's going to respond to a request for access that the business associate receives directly from the individual? Is it going to be the business associate, or is it going to be the covered entity? And how will the business associate respond when there's a request for an accounting of the person's in PHI? Are they going to identify specific permissible purposes the BAA can have, the business associate can have for the PHI, or is it going to be rather general? If the is the business associate allowed to receive this PHI and then de-identify it and use it for other purposes? That's another question that needs to be answered for the BAA. And you can even see these questions on the form. Another one would be whether or not the business associate is going to comply with the covered entity's minimum necessary policies. And it occurs to me that another important thing that isn't even mentioned on this sample is an indemnity provision. In many cases, if the covered entity or the business associate is going to be liable for someone downstream, they may really want to think about whether it's appropriate to put an indemnity clause in that. Now, this is where I think that you go wrong by just picking up a form, because I've seen many times where people brought me forms and they had it backwards. They had themselves as the business associate and the other party as the covered entity, and really that wasn't the case at all. It's just because they filled in the same form that someone gave to them. I've also seen people complete business associate agreements and they didn't have to. They were, for example, a conduit, like an internet service provider, that just is, or like AT&T, phone service. Those kind of entities don't even have to have it because their access is only random or incidental and not for one of the purposes that you mentioned. So a business associate agreement is really something important that must be discussed, must be reviewed, and must be carefully entered into without jumping to put in assignment quickest form. Now, I know there's lots of rules, and I want to know what else we need to know.
Well, here's a quote on slide 17, which really kind of fits these myriad of new rules. The more laws, the more offenders. So there are so many new laws. We really want to make sure that we're complying with all of them so we don't become an unwitting offender. So here's one of the big changes to the final rule. And this was kind of unexpected. This wasn't at all in the proposed rule, which came out in 2010. So everyone was a little bit shocked when they saw this. But under the proposed rule, a breach only occurred if there was a significant risk of harm to the individual whose information was compromised. Well, in the final omnibus rule, the regulators have completely gotten rid of the harm standard. So no longer, when you're looking at whether, you know, there's been a potential breach, or you're trying to determine whether a breach has occurred, you have to analyze whether there was a significant risk of harm to the individual. No longer is that the case. The regulators backed off that standard because they didn't like it. They thought it sounded a little too subjective, left a little bit too much wiggle room to determine that, no, there really wasn't a significant risk of harm here. So here's the new standard. The question you ask is, has the data been compromised? That compromise is so, so broad. And if you can't demonstrate with some sort of reasonable certainty that the data hasn't been compromised, then you have to treat it as a breach and report. And it's kind of tough to think of a situation where there's a potential leak of information that you couldn't make an argument that it was compromised. So really, what the expected result of this is there's going to be a large influx of reportable breaches, because most everything could pretty much be treated as a compromise of protected health information, any sort of breach. So that's something to very much be aware of. Now on slide 19, going hand in hand in that, is you have to be aware of these new breach penalties. So now we have a lower standard of what is a breach, and they've raised what the penalties are for those breaches. But really what's interesting of what they've done is they've created a tiered structure. So tier A, which is kind of the low fault tier, is when the entity didn't know of the violation and could not have known with even sort of reasonable diligence that there was a violation. So the penalty for that is $100,000 to $50,000 for each violation, capped at $1.5 million. And we'll talk about the caps in a little bit because that's a bit deceiving. The next tier of fault, if you will, is a violation that was due to reasonable cause but not due to willful neglect. Again, it was a reasonable cause. It wasn't completely out of their hands, but, you know, we can kind of see how that would happen. And it wasn't due to willful neglect, meaning a conscious intentional failure or reckless indifference on the part of the entity. So, okay, that's not terrible. Here's the next standard of penalty. So that's $1,000 to $50,000. Again, capped at $1.5 million. So the next tier of culpability is Tier C, violation due to willful neglect that was timely corrected. Now again, willful neglect means conscious, intentional failure or reckless indifference to the need to comply with the law. But they say, okay, you were willfully neglectful, you caused this breach, but you fixed it promptly. $10,000 to $50,000 for each violation, capped at $1.5. Now we get to Tier D, where there was willful neglect and you didn't do anything to fix it and it went on for a long time. There the penalty is $50,000 per violation, capped at $1.5. Now, talking about this $1.5 million cap, note that the cap is not per incident, it's per violation. And many times when they find that there's been a problem, there's a number of violations. So, for example, when, you know, 500 different patients' information was compromised, that's when you can start getting huge, huge penalties. So don't think, okay, $1.5 million, even if we do a terrible job, okay, you know, well, things could be worse. No, that's a per violation, not per incident. Moving on to slide 20, to comply with these new breach reporting standards, you're going to want to look at what your organization's current breach reporting policies and procedures are, because they're going to need to be updated to comply with the whole new definition of what a breach is. So for organizations who have existing policies and procedures regarding the protection of PHI, you'll want to revise those to comply with the new breach standard. For organizations who now must implement policies and procedures, for those organizations would be business associates who previously only face contractual liability based on their business associate agreements, but are now directly bound by many of the provisions of the HIPAA law, thanks to the final omnibus rule, they've got to do everything that a covered entity would, mostly, such as policies and procedures, they need to designate a security officer, and they need to conduct employee training. So if you are one of those business associates who's now bound by the provisions of HIPAA, or at least a majority of the provisions of HIPAA, we've got to start from scratch. You've got to get on those policies and procedures. You've got to make sure you're designating a security officer, and you've got to get on employee training.
So, Brooke, I can just see already that many people are going to say, hey, I'm just a little one-person shop. I'm just too small. I mean, what's the real likelihood that I'm going to get caught?
Well, we've seen even the little guys get caught by these rules. Unfortunately, your organization is not too small to be caught. We have a couple of examples of some small fishes and some big fishes that were caught by the rules. So, Julie?
Yes. Well, I know I also practice in Arizona, and I know that the Phoenix cardiac surgery was recently fined $100,000. And when they looked at what they had done, they had posted surgery schedules on the Internet that were accessible from the web that had some patient information. They also had failed to do the things that HHS and OCR had really required, and that was they failed to have adequate policies and procedures to safeguard the information. They failed to document employee training. They failed to identify a security officer. They failed to sign business associates with its business associates. So I guess you can't say you're too small. What have you heard?
Well, Massachusetts General Hospital recently agreed to settle claims that had violated HIPAA with the government for $1 million. The government alleged the hospital failed to implement adequate policies and procedures regarding protection of the PHI of its patients, which really goes to show how important policies and procedures are. The regulators show up at your door, but it's going to be the first thing that they ask for. They're going to say, show me your policies and procedures. Show me the records about how you've trained your employees. We want to see that you guys are taking this seriously. So really, having adequate policies and procedures is your first line of defense. And in this case, the hospital wasn't able to demonstrate that they'd put enough thought and good faith effort into their policies and procedures about protecting their patients' health information, and they had to pay dearly for it.
Well, I heard about another situation in Massachusetts where a medical group had to pay a $1.5 million settlement because they failed to take the necessary steps, such as conducting a risk analysis of the confidentiality of the electronic PHI that they had on their portable devices. And that prompted a breach report, which originally arose out of a stolen employee laptop. So I guess we really do need to be aware of these kind of things. But really, what's the bottom line?
Well, Julie, the bottom line is that audits are happening. They're happening now. We've seen increased audit activity all across the country, and regulators are going to show up, or maybe there's a good chance they'll show up on your doorstep and say, show us what you've got. Show us your policies and procedures. Show us your training. Show us what you've done to comply with the regulations. So audits are happening. Number two, your organization is not too small to be noticed. We've seen six-figure, sometimes seven-figure penalties lately on small medical groups, medical practices for violations of HIPAA. Things as small as, a receptionist posting information on Facebook, losing a smartphone. These are the trivial events that can result in huge penalties when proper precautions aren't taken. Now, of course, you can't prevent that an employee's, you can't make sure an employee's not going to lose their phone or leave a thumb drive somewhere. But you can have policies and procedures about what to do in the event that that happens and what kind of safety precautions you're going to have to mitigate the damage if it does happen. So preparation is key. That's why the best defense is a good offense. Get ready now. You can't necessarily prevent the breaches from happening, but you can make sure that you've got everything in line to respond correctly when they do.
Well, in terms of that, I think there are some things that now we should really think about, and there are some things that we can do to help with that. One thing, I know there's going to be a question of whether a financial institution has to comply with these kind of rules, and the answer that was provided in the comments to the rules said that a financial institution generally is protected by Section 1179 exception when they are conducting solely payment activities. However, the rules say that if a bank or financial institution can be a business associate when the institution performs functions above and beyond the payment processing activities, such as performing accounts receivable functions on behalf of the healthcare provider. So I would say the first thing we can do is identify whether these rules apply and what part of the rules would apply to you specifically. We also routinely review and revise standard business associate agreements to comply with the final rule. We review and revise all the business associate agreements that are currently in place because, as we pointed out earlier, there might just be some requirements that need to be carried through to the downstream entities that aren't typical in a form business associate agreement. Also, we've got to make sure those labels are correct. The form that's posted by HHS deals with a covered entity and a business associate. But when a business associate is going to deal with its business associate, we want to make sure that that's labeled correctly as a business associate and perhaps a subcontractor or other name, so that you tailor that specifically to the downstream contract rather than the original one with the covered entity. We recommend that all the business associate agreements be identified so that you can find where there is a missing one, where there is one that's going to expire. If you're going to rely on the grandfathering provisions that you talked about before, we need to be very careful of when those expire, because if they expired before 2014, you wouldn't be in compliance all the way to September 2014. Another thing is, the grandfathering it protects those business associate agreements that were in place, as you explained, and compliant on January 25th of this year. Well, if we got it together and we sent it to the other side and now we did our inventory and found out that it was never signed, that business associate agreement is not compliant and they need to deal with that the September 23rd year rule of this year. So that's another thing we can do is help identify those particular contracts and conduct and review the inventory that should be started right now. We also can revise the organization's notice of privacy practices. Now, one thing I didn't mention earlier is that the rules talk about a hybrid entity. Now, a hybrid entity is an entity that its main function really isn't providing health care, but perhaps they have a portion of their business that provides health care. So what the rules allow them to do is identify themselves as a hybrid entity, and that portion of the business, the organization that deals with protected health information, will comply with the policies. But they have to make sure that their policies prevent that protected information from getting out to the other part of the organization, just like as if it were a separate company. And a business has to, if it just chooses to be a hybrid, and many businesses will, then it has to clearly define that in its policies. So there's another one that if that seems to apply to your business, we would need to make sure that you have in place the appropriate policies and document it so that it doesn't lose that protection of a hybrid entity and require the entire organization to be in compliance. We can also talk about and help with posting where the NPP has to be posted, how it's going to be distributed, who's going to be responsible for what happens when it needs to be updated, who's going to be responsible for that, those kind of things. And as we've talked about again and again, the policies for breach reporting and for security of the breach really need to be evaluated. As you mentioned with the penalties, there's a difference between when you're penalized and you fix something within 30 days and when you didn't. So your policies should outline how fast things are supposed to happen, who's supposed to report. It also penalties based upon starting when you knew or should have had knowledge of that breach. The policies need to talk about how quickly and who will identify that, so that the reporting can happen promptly and that the incident is properly reported. We haven't even talked about state law. And, of course, we would need to make sure that this also complies with state law, because HIPAA says that if the rules in the state law are stricter than the HIPAA requirements, those additional rules will apply. So in terms of overall compliance, there's a lot of things to do. There's a lot of things that need evaluation. And depending upon the size of your organization, what you need to do, some of the requirements in the security rule say they are, the rule says they're addressable. And some of the rules say they're required. So depending on how data is handled in your organization, there are certain security requirements that must be in place, such as passwording, things like that, that needs to be taken care of in the technological sense. So there's a lot to do.
One other thing that I want to touch on and be clear is that under the omnibus rule, and there are these sweeping new requirements for business associates, whereas business associates previously only faced liability based on the four corners of the BAA they had with the covered entity, now they are directly responsible for various provisions of the HIPAA requirements. So now they have to answer like a covered entity would. So for those business associates, there's a lot of work to be done. You have to start drafting your policies and procedures. You have to provide employees with training, security officer designation, all of these other things that covered entities used to do, now business associates have to do. And that's why many business associates are scrambling, because they've got a lot to do in a relatively short amount of time. And, again, that's something that if you're starting from scratch, we can certainly help you with.
There's also, you mentioned training. What does that mean?
Well, you have to make sure that your employees know exactly what they're supposed to do to protect the protected health information. They have to be familiar with the policies and procedures. They have to be familiar with the various protection mechanisms that your organism has in place. It's no good to have policies and procedures and have all of these rules about how you're going to respond in the event of a breach or what you're going to do to prevent a breach if none of your employees know what they are and don't know how to comply with them. So you have to demonstrate that employees have been trained on what the organization's policies and procedures are regarding the protection of health information.
And again, that's something that we can help with. I think that one of the things that I've heard with regard to the breach reporting is that the first thing that HHS asks for is your risk analysis. And what do they mean by that? They just expect you to have some sort of documentation, or?
Well, they want to make sure that you've actually, in a way, tested out your systems to make sure that, okay, well, you have your compliance plan. What have you guys done to audit yourself to make sure that your compliance plan is working? You know, conduct a risk assessment. Really set back and judge how good your policies are. What have you guys done to audit yourself? And that's going to be another key piece of information that regulators ask for when they come to audit your organization.
And I think that you can't just rely on the fact that they're not going to come to the organization, because the OCR is instigated audits. So those audits are going to be put in place in a larger form than they have been previously. So there's going to be people checking, even if there isn't a breach. So at this point, I think we're ready for questions.
Thank you. We will now begin the question and answer session. If you have a question, please press star, then one on your touchtone phone. If you wish to be removed from the queue, please press the pound sign or the hash key. There will be a delay before the first question is announced. If you are using a speakerphone, you will need to pick up the handset before pressing the numbers. Once again, if you have a question, that's star, then one on your touchtone phone. Standing by for questions. And Ms. Simer, I'm seeing no questions at this time.
Okay. Well, I'm hoping that's a good sign. And we have our email on the material. Please feel free to email us with questions or follow-up. This is a very extensive rule, and there's a lot that's going to raise some new issues and questions in the future. So feel free to contact either of us. And we really want to thank you for your time and in being here for our presentation today. Thank you.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. This concludes today's conference. Thank you for participating. You may now disconnect.